the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've got a very special show lined up for you today. It's one you're going to stay with from beginning to end, and then you're going to stick around demanding more at the end, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Alan Goodman, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're going to be talking about the showdown that's going on between the Republicans and the Democrats, the shutdown of the government, what it all means for society and for all of us, and what the hell we can do about it in the face of it, all right? But before that, before we get there, we are going to open the show up with a very special topic. It's one that's very close to my heart, and it's with a person that we've talked to before, I think maybe about a year ago or so, a little bit more than a year ago, and we talked with him about the state of the oceans. Just a little while ago, in early October, the International Program on the State of the Ocean developed a whole new study on what the hell is happening with the oceans. And if you remember, this is a group that we talked to a little while ago, and we talked with them about what's going on with the oceans, and the report indicated that there was some very, very heavy stuff, that the oceans were in dire straits, and in fact, that the entire planet and the fate of humanity was at stake there. And this report that they just came out with says straight up, things are a hell of a lot worse than we thought, folks. They're very, very bad, and we've got to do something about it. And joining us to talk about all that is our guest, Professor Alex Rogers. Alex Rogers is a professor at Somerville College and Oxford and the scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Oceans. And he is one of the co-authors of this brand new study. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Sure. Good to talk with you again, man, even especially as we're facing these circumstances that we're in. Tell me this, man, because I want to get as much time with you as possible today. Tell me this. Just a couple weeks ago, the beginning of October, you were part of an international panel of marine scientists that demanded urgent remedies to halt ocean degradation based on findings that things are worse than you initially reported in the 2011 report. How bad is it, and what's changed since the first report?
Well, what's changed is that in the 2011 report, we obviously looked at multiple stressors on the oceans. And the thing that's changed now is that even in that short period of time, which is, I guess, two and a half years, more science has been done. So this has allowed us to really look at some of these stresses in more detail, and also to confirm some of the things that we reported in 2011, some of which were probably a little controversial amongst the scientific community and maybe wider public at the time. But since then, we've seen scientific information come out from work that's been in progress. That's really reinforced some of those messages that we reported on in 2011.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get into the particulars of this, but I wanted to also find out, just as to sort of frame this, how bad is it, man?
It's extremely bad. I mean, the one of the main findings that has really come out in scientific literature over the past 2 years has been that scientists have been able to look back through geological time and compare what's happening now to what's happened in the past when we've seen significant extinction events. And disturbingly, what's been found is that many of the symptoms of what we're seeing in present-day climate change were there in past periods of mass extinction associated with disturbances in the carbon cycle.
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back to extinctions because that's a particular question. Well, maybe we can jump into this now. When you say extinctions, that the signs that were there, that are here now, were there present during many of the past extinctions. You also made in this report, it also made a comparison between now and other periods of mass extinction and said that the next one may have already begun.
That's right. I mean, when people think of a mass extinction in the past, they think all of a sudden, you know, a whole fauna changes almost overnight. But actually, historic mass extinctions take place over quite a long period of time, certainly hundreds of thousands of years, maybe even millions, possible exceptions being the end of the Cretaceous, when, of course, the Earth was hit by a large meteorite. But one of the things that's really coming through from the research at the moment is how unique the current event is And it's unique because of the extremely high rate of carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere. And, of course, that means it's being absorbed by the oceans at a very high rate as well.
Now, just so people are clear, when you talk about mass extinctions, what are we talking about here? What exactly is a mass extinction?
Well, this is a period of time over which the extinction rate goes above normal background levels of extinction. Because, of course, at any particular period of time, there will be a certain number of species going extinct, as well as new species appearing by speciation. So an extinction, a mass extinction event, is when we see a large number of extinctions take place, which is way above the background level and generally of such a scale that we can detect that in the fossil record.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things, you know, are there certain things that you would actually say, like you could look at this and say, look, there are signs that this is happening. You know, it seems to me these are like major, just so people are clear, when you're talking about mass extinctions, you're actually talking about a major shift in the whole way life exists on the planet, right?
Well, we're already seeing some very dramatic shifts in marine life. So as the oceans have absorbed something like 90% of the extra heat that's been generated in the atmosphere as a result of greenhouse gas emissions. And so already we're seeing dramatic shifts in the distribution of species towards the poles. We've also seen these mass die-off events of corals, these mass bleaching events as a result of increased temperature. And of course, this is happening against the background of over-exploitation of many marine resources through overfishing. So although we're seeing symptoms which have been seen in the past associated with disturbances to the carbon cycle, we've also nowadays got other stressors which are already there and already acting on marine ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into the content, the meat of this thing, because one of the things that you in the piece that you wrote in as part of the study, and also in the overall report on the study, the things that they talk about that are spoken about in terms of the major things that are changing. One of the most important things, it seemed to me in reading this, is that what's called the deadly trio and the deoxygenation, the acidification, and the warming in the oceans. Let's talk about them both individually, explain to people what those things are, but then also what happens when these three things are working together.
Yeah, I mean, obviously warming is temperature rise. So in some parts of the ocean, we've seen increases in temperature of more than 1 degree C. This might not sound that significant to your listeners, but biologically, that's highly significant, and that's what's leading to these shifts in distribution. Also, we're seeing this phenomenon of deoxygenation, where oxygen levels are being reduced in the oceans. And this is happening through several routes. One of those routes is through agricultural runoff into the coastal zone, creating these so-called dead zones. And we've seen a proliferation of those probably over the last 40 or 50 years, as we've seen industrial fertilizers being increasingly used in agriculture. Also, the heating effect on the ocean reduces the vertical mixing of the oceans, and, of course, warm water can carry less oxygen than cold water. And what this is causing out in the oceans is an expansion in depth terms of what's called the oxygen minimum zone. And this is a zone of the water column that naturally has lower oxygen than surface waters. And it's been shown that already this is compressing the habitat of fast-swimming ocean predators like marlins, which need very high oxygen, need a high oxygen content in the water. Acidification has been nicknamed global warming's evil twin. And I think the reason for that is that it sort of crept up on us almost unawares, and it actually has caught the scientific community out as well as the public. And this is caused by carbon dioxide being absorbed into seawater. This is converted to carbonic acid, and this reduces the how alkaline seawater is. or makes it more acid. And this has all sorts of biological consequences, one of which is to reduce the amount of calcium carbonate dissolved in seawater. And, of course, many marine animals use that to build shells or skeletons.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show and you're listening to Today We're Talking With Alex Rogers. And Alex is a professor of conservation biology at the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford and a fellow of Somerville College. He's a marine biologist with special expertise on deep sea ecosystems. And he is one of the authors. He's the scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Ocean. And he's one of the authors of IPSO. Put out is one of the publishers, one of the co-publishers of this new report on the state of the ocean. And it's extremely, I'll tell you, you can't look at this, you can't read this without being extremely disturbed and just angry as hell. And Alex, I want to ask you then again, you have these things, you have this deadly trio, rather than, and I was really kind of amazed and stunned by the way when I dug into the report and the fact that these three things individually are problematic on their own. At the same time, you're talking about we have a situation where they work in synergy with one another, and it seems it compounds the effect of all of them, any one of them individually, right?
That's absolutely right. So, for example, studies have been done around natural carbon dioxide events. These are places which are volcanically active where carbon dioxide bubbles out the seabed. And in these places, it's been shown that there's an interaction between the acidification effect of the CO2 bubbling through the seawater, but also temperature. So at high temperatures, organisms, animals, are more seriously affected by the acidification than they are in cooler water. So there's a direct interaction between those two particular elements in the deadly trio. But if you think about the physiology of any animal, you will know that obviously we breathe in oxygen. If we get hot, our metabolic rate increases, so we demand even more oxygen. And really, it's down to the actual biology of most large organisms, most animals, that there are interactions between these phenomena, right down to the level of the way that the animal operates. Mm-hmm. But certainly on an environmental level, often those things work together. So warmer water, as I said, carries less oxygen. It also has the effect of raising the metabolic rate of organisms living in it. And, you know, therefore, the effect of the whole of this trio of phenomena is actually much greater than if you took any one of them singly.
Mm-hmm. Does this kind of thing also lead to algae blooms?
Algae blooms are thought to be, basically caused by a number of things. One of the things that's thought to encourage those is rising temperature. Also, where you get enrichment of coastal waters with nutrients such as nitrates, that also encourages the bloom of these things. And the other thing that happens is where you get an ecosystem that's had some of its building blocks taken out because of, for example, overfishing, then that can also encourage really almost unnatural behavior of the system. So again, it's a combination of things that can bring about favorable conditions for the proliferation of a harmful algal bloom.
Now, let me ask you this, Alex. You made a point that the ocean has actually been bearing the brunt of climate change on the Earth. And I wanted you to explain that and then go into a little bit more the question of, you know, because at the same time, you've also spoken about the ocean at some point not being able to absorb any more carbon dioxide at all, that it reaches a saturation point. And I want to talk about what causes that and what's the impact of that. So two questions there. One is, what does it mean that the ocean has been bearing the brunt of climate change? And what about this reaching a saturation point and the impact of that?
Yeah, this is something we've learned a lot more about between the first and the second IPSO reports. So in 2012, there was a very informative paper published which actually shows that the oceans, as I said earlier, have absorbed 90% of the excess heat in the atmosphere resulting from emission of greenhouse gases. So in that sense, the oceans really have taken the brunt of heat. And of course, after the last IPCC report was published a couple of weeks ago, a lot of people jumped on this fact that atmospheric temperatures appear to have been quite stable over the last 10 years. That's reflected in the surface layers of the oceans. But actually, while temperatures have been quite stable in the atmosphere and the surface layers of the oceans, over this period of time, the deep ocean, the zone between 700 and 2,000 meters, has been warming up. So the oceans have actually been absorbing this excess heat, and it's thought that that is why we're not seeing such serious temperature rises in the atmosphere and surface oceans. Also, the oceans are absorbing something like a third of the CO2 that we're emitting, and in fact are the major storage place of carbon dioxide. And that's why we've seen this acidification problem coming into being. And we're really seeing now, as I said, quite serious and, in fact, in some ways remarkable changes in marine ecosystems as a result of these climate change-driven changes in the physical environment. Now, of course, the ocean has a buffering capacity, something called alkalinity. And the reason that pH has started to drop in the oceans is because we're actually overcoming that buffering effect simply due to the rate at which we're pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And this is all about rates. You'll often hear people say, oh, yes, but of course carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have been much higher in the past. That is very true. But the thing that we've now found out is that it is likely that the rate of CO2 injection into the atmosphere has probably not been seen for at least 300 million years.
That's incredible. That was going to be my next question. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alex Rogers, who is part of the science director of the International Program for the State of the Ocean, and he's one of the co-authors of the IPSO is one of the co-authors of this new program, this new report on the State of the Ocean 2013 Perils, Prognosis, and Proposals. And it's really a harrowing and frightening and enraging report when you go all the way through it. Now, Alex, I was just going to go on to that point that you were just starting to get into, that this kind of change, the change that we're seeing in the oceans right now, is in terms of scale and rate, is unprecedented in the known history of the Earth and is exposing organisms to intolerable and unpredictable evolutionary pressure. What are we talking about there, and what's the significance of it?
Yeah, well, if temperatures and if CO2 levels were rising slowly, then organisms naturally adapt to changes in the environment, essentially through processes of evolution. And I've done a lot of work in the Antarctic, where, of course, temperatures are much lower than elsewhere. And there, we can see clearly the signatures of how those animals have evolved. They've evolved things like antifreeze proteins and various other ways of coping with very low temperatures and the presence of ice. But they've been able to do that because Antarctica has cooled over tens of millions of years. Now, of course, if we were talking about these types of changes over those timescales, it would not be a problem. The issue is that the CO2 levels are increasing so fast and temperatures are increasing so rapidly and that organisms don't have a chance to adapt to these changes. And that's why we're seeing, first of all, shifts in distribution, but also mortality events associated with, for example, high temperature.
All right, we have a couple more questions, Alex, and these are one's short and one's going to be relatively, I think, involved. But we have about 7 minutes to get through this, and I wanted to ask you this: are there tipping points right now when you look out at what's going on and you know how bad it is? And this whole process has been described as, I can't remember what was it called. It was called by the UN. These changes are progressive and relentless. And are there tipping points that you're really concerned about now when you look at it and say, okay, it's really bad. We're really kind of screwed here, folks. But what are tipping points that you're looking to as, like, it's just reached this terrible, even more terrible place?
Well, I think one of the really quite concerning things about this whole process is that we've already passed some tipping points. And I'll give you one example. That was in 1979 when we saw the world's first mass coral bleaching events as a result of elevated temperature. That was a tipping point for that particular ecosystem. That happened, and we didn't even realize that it had taken place until later, when we saw that these events were happening with increasing frequency as a result of warming of the waters in which those corals live. I think one of the really concerning tipping points is associated with acidification. I think if emissions continue the way they are, by the end of the century, we will see serious biological impacts as a result of this acidification process. It will help, it will actually push coral reefs together with warming towards essentially elimination, as at least in terms of the way that coral ecosystems are today. It will certainly start to have major impacts on polar ecosystems, because cold water absorbs more carbon dioxide, and therefore polar waters becoming acidic more quickly than anywhere else. The other one is oxygen, and I think if we see a serious change in the oxygen state of the deep ocean, that's when I think things will really start to change across vast, vast areas of the ocean. And already, as I said, these oxygen minimum zones are getting broader in their vertical extent, and it's been estimated that we're already pushing something like, I think it was 800 cubic kilometers of seawater into this lower oxygen state every year as a result of this expansion of OMZ. And I can't recollect whether that is the actual figure, but I think it was something like that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the tipping points in terms of the goods and services the ocean provides for us. And in particular, the one that we need to be very worried about is its ability to absorb carbon dioxide. And certainly some of the effects on the ocean may feed back to its ability to actually take up carbon dioxide. And that's when things get really problematic, because, of course, at that point, we would see accelerated rates of accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Now, the last question, Alex, you've described, or your report has described, the situation as having huge implications for humans and the most important challenge faced since hominids evolved. Now, if there were absolutely no conditioning factors, somebody just came to you and said, Alex Rogers, you and the IPSO, if you could do whatever you needed to do to turn this, to reverse this whole scene, restore the oceans, restore the health of the planet, what would you do?
The very first step would be a dramatic reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. Without that, basically, we're heading towards a very, very serious change of the Earth system. So that has to be step one. And that means that states have to get together and get over their disagreements over who's to blame and who's going to, you know, actually take the brunt of the cuts. We're all in this together. And I don't think we understate the seriousness of this situation. It should be being treated as a global emergency. And really, it needs almost a Marshall Plan to actually deal with the situation.
All right, Alex, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and probably we're going to have you back as soon as these things develop, which seems to be at a breakneck pace. So Look forward to talking to you again, man.
Yeah, thanks right. very much, Michael. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care now. Bye.
Cheers.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Alex Rogers, a professor of conservation biology at the Department of Zoology, University of Oxford, and a fellow of Somerville College. He's also a marine biologist with special expertise on the deep sea ecosystems, and he is scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Ocean. And they analyze current impacts on marine ecosystems globally, and they just were one of two groups that had put out a report on the State of the Ocean 2013. And it's a really frightening and enraging report. You want to get a copy of it, you need to dig this up and find it and read it and think about what you're doing. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Alan Goodman and what the hell is going on with the showdown, the shutdown, and everything that's unfolding around that. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. right, welcome back. That was Uprising from Wadada Leo Smith and Ed Blackwell. And, you know, just a little while ago, as everyone is sitting there and everybody knows and everybody's paying a lot of attention to this, the government shutdown has been dominating the news. Republicans and Democrats fight in a stalemate, unable to agree. There's talk, including by mainstream commentators, that our democracy is imperiled, quote unquote. Each night witnesses a parade of extreme right-wing demagogues dominating the cable news shows, influencing the thinking of millions and rallying people to their side. What's going on? Is the situation as serious as some say? Why? Who are these Republicans? Are they just lunatics, fools, and racists? Or are they actually proceeding with a strategy and a goal in mind? And what about the Democrats? Are they finally standing up for reason? Why do these disagreements seem so bitter? Is it for real? Is it for short-term advantage? Or is it just fakery altogether? What's really being fought over? Is it only about health care? What stakes, if any, do the masses of people in the U.S., but more important all around the world, have in this conflict? And what challenge does this pose to those who really want to see a better world? Well, that's the beginning of an article that you can access and read the full article on the site revcom.us. And the article's titled, The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. And joining us now to talk about that article is Alan Goodman, a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you back, man. Well, let's talk about this. I read the beginning of it, and, you know, there's a, you know, like as I said, the title of the article is The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. Let's look at this. Why don't we just start with the first part of that headline, The Shutdown and The Showdown. What's going
sure.
on, man? How serious is it?
Well, it's serious. You know, before we begin to dig into this, let me just sort of a disclaimer of sorts that this is a very substantial article. You can't miss it at revcom.us. It's right on the homepage. The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. And I think, you know, what I will aim to do is give your listeners a sense of some of the things covered there and share some of that analysis, but consider this sort of a trailer for the article itself. But in terms of what you're asking, I think the article begins by just because a lot of people are being drawn into this situation, you know, and just what the heck is going on. So, I mean, basically the situation is that a faction of the Republicans in Congress have been blocking what is called a continuing resolution that keeps the United States government funded. And they are doing that by saying that until the Democrats agree to changes in the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, that is the health care reform bill that was passed 3 years ago, which just began to come into effect, unless the Democrats would agree to changes in that, then they are essentially holding the budget hostage. And the Democrats have answered back that the way the system is supposed to work is that if you don't like a law, you're supposed to, you know, get it repealed and, if necessary, override a presidential veto. And that actually is the way the system works, but one dimension of what makes this whole crisis such a crisis and so profound is that the Republicans really don't care about the rules of the game, and a dominant section of them at this point have essentially said that they're not going to play by those rules. And among other things, you know, this is extortion. There's government programs that are vital to people's lives, like women, infants, and children, food subsidies that are endangering the lives and health of millions of women and children. So this is a high-stakes, strong-arm move. And as I think we're going to get into, it is designed to advance an actual fascist agenda.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alan Goodman, a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about an article that appears on the site revcom.us, and that article is The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. Well, now, tell me this, though. One of the things that this seems to, and it's interesting because people look at this, and the first thing that has been popping out there, and it's been thrown out there a lot by the Tea Party, by the various other lunatics that are out there, is the whole idea that this is centered around Obamacare. This is centered around Obama's medical care program, the thing that's supposed to be being enacted. You know, why are the Republicans so obsessed with Obamacare? And is this really what this is about?
Yes, on one level, it is what it is about. And then on another level, there are even deeper things. But the Obamacare thing does really push their buttons. I mean, first of all, there's an analysis in this article at RevCom that we're talking about, the shutdown, the showdown, and the urgent need to repolarize for revolution. There's an analysis there that I think your listeners are going to find very eye-opening about some of the reasons why a consensus developed within the ruling class that, among other things, in terms of the ability of the U.S. to compete internationally, there had to be changes in sort of the healthcare structure in this country, as well as the fact that, you know, tens of millions of people in this country that spends billions on the military, you know, can't get basic medical care. It poses real issues of whether or not this system is, you know, fit to rule. So for various reasons, a consensus emerged among powerful sections of the capitalist class to implement some health care reform, but Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act is, you know, very far from universal coverage. Businesses aren't required to provide coverage to people working less than 30 hours. Millions of undocumented workers and their families aren't covered. And after all that, the Supreme Court knocked out essentially coverage for millions of people who would have been covered by expanding Medicaid. And they did it on the states' rights rationale, which some of your listeners will recognize as the logic or the court rationale that was used to uphold Jim Crow in the South and before that slavery itself. So as a result of all this, over 68% of the poor people who are supposed to be covered by this law will not be. So it's a very, very conservative health care reform. Nevertheless, the Republicans have opposed this virulently, you know, with extreme rhetoric, arguing that people who can't afford medical insurance should rely on charity. And we have heard from them that the Affordable Care Act was socialist, redistributing wealth, and so on. And here I just have to say that the Affordable Care Act is far from socialist. And if your listeners want to get a sense of how a genuine socialist state would approach health care, there's an excerpt from the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America draft proposal that's a sidebar to this article at RevCom, and your listeners can find the whole Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America at RevCom. So on the one hand, this is, you know, a very mild reform. On the other hand, you know, we do have to break down the virulence of the opposition to it, and part of it is this extreme vicious individualism, especially aimed at the poor and minorities. That's real. That unites all these different Tea Party factions, the Koch brothers, the Christian fascists, and others. Then there's the more unspoken reason, at least on prime time, and that is the insane and poisonous hatred of Obama and black people in general that these Republicans tap into and unleash. When we covered at RevCom.us the original passage of the Affordable Care Act, we quoted Republican Representative Steve King. Now, I have to emphasize two things here. One is, yes, he's a lunatic, but he's getting major primetime promotion now as a spokesperson for the people who want to hold the budget hostage to eviscerate Obamacare or change it. And I have to emphasize that I'm quoting him. This is not me talking now. But here's what he shouted at a Tea Party rally in Washington. And this is a guy in Congress. Listen to this quote. If I could start a country with a bunch of people, they'd be the folks who were standing with us the last few days. Let's hope we don't have to do that. Let's beat that other side to a pulp. Let's take them out. Let's chase them down. There's going to be a reckoning. And members of the same mob then spat on and even hit black congressional representatives trying to make their way into vote, and one of them called Representative John Lewis of Georgia the N-word. So, I mean, to be clear, there are reasons to oppose Obama on a completely different basis. He's the commander-in-chief of the world's sole superpower. His presidency has been used to promote the idea that oppressed people, especially people of color who do not make it in this country, are to blame for that. But that's very different than the reactionary racist venom that these Republicans have tapped into and stirred up. So to answer your question, you know, what is it about the Obamacare thing and is it about the Obamacare thing? there's deeper issues, which I suspect we're about to get into, but this Obamacare thing is a big thing for them. And just to quote from the article, these two streams, the heartless free market fundamentalism and the racist appeals to white male entitlement with a virulent hatred of Obama at the core, are cornerstones of the Republican hatred of the Affordable Care Act.
All right, let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alan Goodman, a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about this story that's you can access at the site revcom.us, and the story is called The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. All right, Alan, as you said, let's get into it. What is at the heart of this then?
Well, what we are dealing with here, and to sort of abbreviate a very substantial exploration of this in the article at RevCom, but this is a crisis in the ruling class. And without getting into every dimension of how this is explored in the article, it makes the point that the state and capitalist society serves several functions. One is it enforces the interests of the ruling class, the capitalist class, against rivals in other countries and the masses of people here and around the world. Examples, Occupy, the violent suppression of Occupy, the stop and frisk situation in the inner cities of the U.S., the prisons full of millions of oppressed people. And around the world, just to take one example, perpetuating the U.S. role in perpetuating the terrible slaughter in Syria. And you'll find plenty more discussion of that in other articles at revcom.us. But here's what the article focuses on, and I'm just going to read a short clip from it. The state must also serve as a vehicle that can mediate conflicts between the different blocks of capitalist imperialists. This includes, but is not limited to, clashes over economic interests. In fact, those clashes are not even the main expression or driving force of the conflicts. To apply it to the current struggle, this is not mainly a battle between some people representing the insurance companies, say, and others representing the auto industry. Politics grows out of and reflects the economic relations in society, but it is also a separate sphere with its own dynamics and logic. And I know that's a concentrated formulation, and again, I encourage readers who are provoked by this or listeners to head to revcom.us and read the article. But here's the point that is focused on, that two sharply contending sections of the ruling class are squaring off in Obamacare, and this budget crisis is kind of, where things are coming to a head around. And I just want to read another clip from that article. It says, "What begins as a battle between two sections of the capitalists over how things should go could turn into something else if there is a force in the midst of this that is showing how both factions do not serve the fundamental interests of the people, how neither can provide a real way out and way forward for people, and how the people themselves must take matters into their own hands and build a movement for revolution to bring into being a society that can solve the terrible problems people face." And the article emphasizes this is not to say that this present crisis will end up going over the brink with either a couple outcomes that are discussed in the article, the Civil War as broke out in 1861 in the United States between contending forces in the ruling class, or revolution. It's not to say that this is going to end up that way, but it's not clear at this point to any of the players where this will go. And there's a point that Bob Avakian makes in his film Revolution Nothing Less, that the measures taken by the ruling class to get out of crisis often or can backfire and things can spin out of control. And again, what the revolutionary forces do in such situations can have great impact one way or the other on how these develop and what ultimately comes out of them. So the article then goes into, and I don't, we'll see what you want to explore in this, but the article goes into sort of the nature of these two contending, clashing ruling class forces, and what it is in terms of the changes in the world over the last couple decades or more that have brought things to the situation that they're in now. But where did you want to go next with this? Or?
Well, let me remind listeners that we're talking with Alan Goodman, correspondent for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the article at revcom.us called The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. Well, where I wanted to go, Alan, is, you know, one of the things that the article talks about a lot is that one of the forces at the heart of this crisis, and you've been indicating this all along, one of the forces at the heart of this crisis are those that the article refers to as a fascist hardcore with a fascist answer. And this is spoken about as more than what many people just sort of dismiss as, well, it's just a slim collection of lunatics. How significant is this?
Well, let's take the answer you posed, a fascist answer, and pose what question is that fascist answer an answer to? And this gets to kind of some of the very profound underlying economic, cultural, demographic changes going on in the U.S. And the article explores the article that we're talking about, The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution at revcom.us. The article gets into this in far more depth than we can do on the radio, but it points to and draws on work done in beginning with the book Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, We Need Morality But Not Traditional Morality by Bob Avakian. And there's some substantial quotes from that book, which I'll only read one short clip or one or two short clips from, but one of those clips is this. This is an era of lean and mean and ever more mobile capitalism. It is about cheapening production, depressing wages and benefit levels, and creating a more flexible and disposable labor force. And it is about massively slashing New Deal, Great Society-type social spending, now decried as unproductive cost burdens. And then skipping ahead a bit to another clip from the excerpt of that book. At the same time, many of these same factors, talking about big changes in the economy and demographics and so on, at the same time, many of these same factors, together with the struggle waged by the women's movement, have resulted in a situation where large numbers of women have not only the necessity but also the possibility of working outside the home. All this has been accompanied by a great deal of turmoil and upheaval, and one of its most important consequences has been that, from a number of angles and among various sectors of the population in the U.S., the basis of the traditional patriarchal family and the traditional family values, quote-unquote, associated with it, has significantly eroded. And yet all these changes are taking place within the confines of the same system on the same foundation of capitalist relations. This, continuing to quote from the book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, this is potentially a very explosive contradiction, and in many aspects this explosiveness is already erupting. So what's being pointed to, and again, you know, we can only sort of scratch the surface of this in this interview, but what's being pointed to are very profound changes in the economy and the demographics and the culture in the United States that are undermining the way that the United States has been held together, so to speak, or cohered for decades.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alan Goodman, a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about an article that appears on the site revcom.us, and that article is The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. One of those places that really comes out is in the fight around abortion rights.
Yes, it does. You know, in the face of these demographic and economic changes and social changes that are undermining the traditional family that I was talking about, you have the Republican platform of outlawing abortion, restricting birth control, and a whole range of getting back to, you know, quote-unquote traditional American values, opposition to immigration reform, disenfranchisement of black people, the arming of white people in rural and suburban areas with military-level weapons, you know, support for racial profiling and stop and frisk, and we could go on and on. So that's the Republicans. In short, to quote the article at revcom.us, in short, these Republic fascists uphold white supremacy, the subjugation of women, nativism, that is, a hatred for those not born in the U.S., and religious fundamentalism, along with a general glorying in ignorance and irrationality, added to this is the very important fact of fascist strength in the military. So that's the Republican side of the equation.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Democrats, man?
Well, in a word, to quote the article, conciliation in the service of empire. If you look at everything I listed and more, starting with the right to abortion, the criminalization of youth, immigration, the environment, where you have the Republicans denying climate change, ask yourself this. When have the Democrats ever called the people who look to them for leadership, generally speaking here, the oppressed and more progressive-minded people in society, to go into the streets and seriously oppose this, let alone disrupt meetings and so on? How did the Democratic mayors, for example, respond to Occupy? Not by welcoming and supporting the protesters, but by unleashing police on them in the dead of night with batons, pepper spray, tear gas canisters. And contrast that to how the Republican politicians responded to the Tea Party. Or again, we can look at how the Democrats treat the Republicans and seek common ground with a party whose official platform, speaking of the Republicans now, opposes all abortions, making no exception for rape and incest or the health of a woman. So, over and over again, we see the Democrats backpedaling in the face of this. But I do want to emphasize and direct your listeners' attention to the point that's made in this article, that while there is underlying unity between the leaders of the two parties over maintaining empire and domestic pillars of that empire, the conflicts between them are quite real. And I think this is important for, especially a section of your listeners who are inclined to, maybe I think we were talking about this earlier, dismiss this as sort of an inconsequential clash. These battles are not in the main phony pro wrestling type posturing. They could easily get out of the control of the antagonists. And so this then poses the ultimate question, what are we going to do about all this?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alan Goodman, a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about an article that appears on the site revcom.us, and that article is The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go with this, and we have about maybe 7 minutes, 6 minutes to deal with this, so let's deal with it. The article that we're talking about paints a rather extreme and urgent picture of what's going on. And you've been making the case it's very hard to dismiss in this interview, and people really need to read the article at revcom.us. But where does that leave us? What should people be doing now, especially if the framework of working within the alternatives of the Republicrats and the Republic fascists is unacceptable, which is what you're indicating. So what the hell do people do?
Well, the things that I'm going to point to are in the context of a serious strategy for revolution, which is found in On the Strategy for Revolution, from the Revolutionary Communist Party, available at revcom.us. And all I can do here is direct people to that strategy. But I do want to emphasize that moments like this are particularly important for anybody serious about serious change. First of all, none of us can be mere spectators in this situation, and we don't have to be. There's a way to go to work on this situation. Look, the situation right now for the overwhelming majority of humanity is already a horror. Look at the Congo or what's being done to the conditions of people who mine what goes into your cell phone in the Congo, or the women working in the sweatshops in Bangladesh that collapse and catch fire, or people living in the Middle East. Or for that matter, in the inner cities and borderlands and Indian reservations of the USA, the situation right now already holds the very prospect of the end of humanity if you look at the environmental crisis and capitalism's plundering of the environment. So it's important to reground ourselves in this, to think about the fact that we are living in a world in which women in their millions each year are sold into sex slavery, and that all this comes from an economic system that's both ruthless and outmoded, both exploitative and insane, and from political structures that enforce and expand that system. So while that's kind of not the main point of our exchange here, it's important to go back to the fact that our orientation here, and here I'm speaking to your listeners, our orientation cannot be, let's get back to the normal operation of capitalism, okay? But then the article that we're talking about at RevCom.us makes this important point, and this is kind of the punchline in a sense. Things don't have to be this way. There is a method and approach for understanding the world and going to work on even the most seemingly daunting of situations. There is a solution to these problems facing the planet and a plan to build a society, both visionary and viable. There is a strategy to make that solution real through revolution, all of which is part of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism, and there is a leadership to actually make revolution in this country embodied in the party that Bob Avakian leads. So, again, there's no alternative to this that has anything positive within the clash of these different ruling class forces that we're talking about. But what your listeners will find when they get into, especially the last part of this article at RevCom.us, is how to actually seize on this moment to build a movement for revolution. And one of the things that listeners can do, get to RevCom, read the article, and then get it out all over, create a big storm with this all over the social media and their networks, tweet it, get it out on Facebook, get it debated, get it circulated, and so on, so that we're having a big discussion of this. And then the article at RevCom.us walks through in depth and detail that we can't go into here how to really get the alternative to capitalism out there in society and be working on these contradictions. And I just want to point to two things, three. One is the battle to get BA everywhere so that there actually is an alternative to the present system that people are wrestling with. A second is to turn people on to RevCom.us, including this article. And again, the article at RevCom.us goes into a whole ensemble of revolutionary work that people can be connecting with and joining with right now. I do want to mention in the context of everything we're talking about that it's especially important that there be a massive outpouring of protest on October 22nd against police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. That has to be part of the picture as all this develops. And to just summarize what we're talking about and where all this leads, the article at RevCom ends this way. The kind of work we are describing can enable the revolutionary movement, with a party at the core, to confront and overcome the very real obstacles in its path to advance and grow through ongoing work and through a series of critical leaps in times of sudden breaks and ruptures with the normal routine to prepare the ground and accumulate forces for revolution and have a real chance at winning. It is how thousands can be brought forward and oriented, organized and trained in a revolutionary way while beginning to reach and influence millions more even before there is a revolutionary situation. And then, when there is a revolutionary situation, those thousands can be a backbone and pivotal force in winning millions to revolution and organizing them in the struggle to carry the revolution through. And that's a quote from On the Strategy for Revolution, which people can find at RevCom.us. One last word. In the midst of great turmoil and hints of greater turmoil to come, this and nothing less is what we must aim for. So I'll leave you with that.
All right, Alan. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Take care now. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Revolution correspondent Alan Goodman about an article on the site RevCom.us called The Shutdown, The Showdown, and the Urgent Need to Repolarize for Revolution. Get there, check it out, make sure you really dig into it, because I think it's going to knock your socks off. All right, well, that brings us close to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank all of my guests today. Professor Alex Rogers and Alan Goodman. I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and our brand new intern, Nelish Lalani. Now, if you want to follow the show, you can do so through Twitter and Facebook. If you want to volunteer for the show, I'm telling you, we have a lot of work for people to do. You don't have to live in the same city as us. You can do it anywhere in the country. We have need for people to transcribe interviews. We have need for people to help do research, all kinds of things, to spread the word on the social media, everything. If there's a way to actually for you to plug in, we'll find it, and you can do it. So just write to us at michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to just write to us for any reason at all, do so at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Sunny Meadows and Just Like Germany Before the War.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war. A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time, taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. Taking us back to Germany just before. Balance of power shifted when the people cast their vote. Our lining up the victims, the villains, and the scapegoats. And we're all singing hallelujah, death penalty's been restored. Just like in Germany, just before the war. We used to feed the hungry, care for the disabled and the poor. We used to care about civil rights, but we don't give a damn anymore.